In the thin gray autumn dawn of the next morning, Don silently arose, dressed, slid his electric ground car quietly out of the garage, and went into work early, leaving his sleeping wife to enjoy a late breakfast courtesy of her daughters. Don grabbed a breakfast tray at the basement canteen and spent the next several hours at his desk going over old boss files he pulled out of the archives on the hunt for Trudy Griner. Some were in odd-fashioned manila file folders, some on ancient computer 3.5 diskettes, and others had been transcribed to modern plasma tubes. These records were handy because they contained what surprisingly little documentation had been recovered from the Federal Intelligence Services regarding the Ravenhill Ranch ambush. Sarah had told Don that in a past life he was once a medieval monk in charge of a scriptorium, and certainly he had an innate love of anything to do with books and paper documents. Computers and corns and readographs seemed crass to him. Those files also included contemporary news media reports of the ambush, including glass-eyed newspaper clippings and video clips of the news reportage from such old-time media groups as CNN and Fox News. Don watched the CNN aerial footage of the Ravenhill ambush on his screen for a couple of minutes, and then abruptly switched it off and moved on. The office was filling up with his brother officers coming into work, and he did not want to see them to see him weep. There was a sworn statement from the vice president of the Bank of America branch in Westlake, one J.P. Vandermeer, regarding the cutting and issuing of a certified cashier's check, number 844-672-8876, to one Gertrude Griner. Redmond made a note to see if Vandermeer would be located at the state. The $1 million promised to be the one fly in any ointment. Most importantly, boss files contained updated bios and addresses on the survivors of the Ravenhill disaster. At 1,000 hours, Don met with General Stephen Capshaw, his David Nivenish superior. On Capshaw's left cheek was a long scar that complemented his aristocratic appearance. It might have been a saber scar from some collegiate duel in a 19th century German university. In fact, it had been inflicted on Capshaw at age 20 with a razor blade embedded in a toothbrush by a Jamaican inmate in Britain's infamous Parkhurst prison on the Isle of Wight, where Capshaw had been doing a stretch under the equally infamous Race Relations Act for British National Party activity. "John Corbett wants me to do something for him," Redmond told him. "So I gathered, Colonel. Can you tell me about this one?" inquired Capshaw politely. "I don't see why not, sir," said Don. "John C. didn't say not to, and one way or the other, in a few weeks, everyone is going to know about it. The Northwest American Republic is in for a bit of high drama, it seems. Trudy Griner is coming back. Says she's innocent." "Trudy Griner," said Capshaw, frowning and puffing on his Dunhill pipe. "Ah, yes. The Olympic flying column incident. Nasty business, that. Nastier than that, we don't get him." Don went over his latest assignment from the president, point by point. "Yes, I see," said Capshaw with a frown, when Redmond had finished. "A bit of a balls up. Eh, what? A skeleton from the Republic's early days about to come dancing out of the closet. Rum show all around. I don't envy you this one, Redmond. Dancing skeletons can be a damn nuisance. They call their own tune, and sometimes they refuse to stay buried. This one could blow up in your faces, if you'll pardon my mixed metaphors." "Do skeletons explode?" asked Don. "Sometimes they can, yes," replied Capshaw grimly, pipe smoke curling over his head. "If the Griner woman is truly innocent, then it may force some rewriting of this country's history in a way we can ill afford. Plus, there is the problem of just who the bloody hell did grass on Murdoch and his crew if she didn't, and what they may have been up to in the intervening time. Doesn't paint the Bureau of State Security in a very flattering light, does it? Lying down on the job for more than 30 years? Very bad cess indeed. See here, Redmond, do you think this is sufficiently sensitive to merit a delay in breaking in your new partner? In view of the social, political, and military eminence of some of the people you will have to speak with, You might want to put a more senior man, rather than a detective sergeant. I can pull Captain Brady or Major Englehart off their present assignments, offered Capshaw. Don shook his head. Sir, Brady is tracking a very dangerous mole who has betrayed some of our sanction-busting overseas suppliers to the Americans. Several key men in those companies within the United States have disappeared, presumed arrested, and are executed by the Office of Northwest Recovery. We need to plug that leak fast before others get the idea we can't protect our friends and certain very necessary sources of supply dry up. Englehart is on loan to the War Prevention Bureau, and he's hunting in New York. No idea who he's hunting, and I don't need to know, but they wouldn't have sent him if he wasn't needed, so he's unavailable. I don't see why I shouldn't take a sergeant. I've worked with Henny Nell on several prior task forces, and we mesh well, as I recall. He follows orders and seems to grasp the essentials of a case quickly. He's a very good record with the Civil Guard, not just as a street cop, but also as a couple of years a detective with the CID, working regular criminal cases before he applied for boss. Despite the possible implications, I don't think I'm going to run into any seriously sticky situations after all these years. If I do, he's the Washington State Bare Knuckles champion, and he's got a 2 line-of-duty kills of his credit. Frankly, I'm not certain I'm going to be able to find anything at all. We may just have to sit back and listen to what Trudy has to say when she shows up. If she shows up. Don't worry, Nell will do me fine.
Rather a moody chap, wouldn't you say? Suggested Capshaw.
Of course, most of these yapies are.
In view of the fact that their nation is on the verge of extinction and there are now more Afrikaners here in the homeland than there are remaining in South Africa, I can understand why he's moody on occasion. The Aryan race is about to lose her youngest child beyond recovery. It's a horrific tragedy which I frankly don't think the Republic is doing quite enough to prevent. Quite, said Capshaw. My understanding is that we're allegedly just waiting for the right time to intervene in South Africa and restore white rule there. We've been waiting for several decades, and now there's virtually nothing left to restore. Pragmatic tendency and all that rot. Right, Nell it is. Off you go, then. Don made a call in his pocket comm when he had returned to his own office, and he found his new partner, Sergeant Henrik Nell, waiting for him. Nell was a square-built, burly Afrikaner, with a blonde buzz cut, who looked completely at home in the sharp creases of the broadcloth zoot suit he wore, although he didn't seem to have a hat. His face was battered from several thousand blows he had received during bare-knuckle boxing fights, his nose bent and both ears well cauliflowered, but in the Republic such a physiognomy was considered to be one of the most honorable and manly of any, the badge of the NAR's second national sport, the first being riflery. Redmond had familiarized himself with Nell's personnel file and was well aware that the sergeant was legally supporting 4 illegitimate children in addition to his 4 legitimate ones, which his prize purses in addition to the Republic's child allowances enabled him to do. Northwest women notoriously found a true Aryan warrior irresistible. "Morning, Sarge," Redmond greeted him. "Good morning, Colonel," replied Nell in his stilted accent, almost Cockney-like to anyone not familiar with the dialect of Africa's white tribe. "Sergeant, looks like our first job in harness together's gonna be a pretty odd one," said Redmond, without preamble. "You'll be assisting me on a special assignment which has been given to me personally by the state president, John Morgan. You've heard of cold cases. This one is right out of the deep freeze. Goes back to the time of the Revolution, here in the Northwest, during the War of Independence. You may have heard of Tom Murdoch and the Olympic Flying Column?" "Yah," replied Nell. "They were a white commando unit who were massacred by fatties at a place called Ravenhill Ranch." Nell furrowed his brow. "Before my time, XA, but I saw something about it on the telly once. They were sold out to Zog for money by some damn woman. What about them?" "The damn woman is coming back," said Redmond sourly. "We got a letter from Trudy Griner saying she's walking through the Mountain Gate border crossing on October 22nd. Says she's innocent, and she's demanding that we prove otherwise in public before string her up. Great Independence Day present, huh?"
"Kais! So what does the state president want us to do about it?" asked Nell,
Track her down in Aztlan and kill her. Lekker, I'm your own, but I seem to recall the WPB has been trying to do just that for more than 30 years. How are we supposed to succeed in less than 3 weeks?
No. We're going to go over that whole episode in our history as if it were a fresh criminal case. Look at the evidence, talk to witnesses, your whole basic copper drill. Trudy Griner is demanding that the Republic put her on trial and prove she committed racial treason. Our job is to find out whether we can prove it. Quickly and concisely, Redman ran down the details and the nature of their assignment. 8 volunteers from the Olympic Flying Column survived the ambush at Ravenhill Ranch because they weren't there when it went down. We'd better hope that one of those veterans has some new angle we can work on, some new bit of information. Otherwise, we may get caught with our pants down if it turns out that Trudy Griner has been sitting on some kind of bombshell for the past 30-odd years. So do we know where all 8 of the survivors are now? Asked Nell, practically. Yes. In some cases, they have made quite a splash since the war. Big Bill Vitale is probably the most well-known of them. He's on duty down in the Idaho border, and it may take us some time to track him down. We'll see him last, but the others shouldn't be too hard to find. Admiral David Leach, we will be able to see at Bremerton Navy Yard, where he is in charge of a major construction project. I'll call him on the way up there and see if we can get an appointment. Frank Palmieri is very much a technocrat, continued Redman. No mean politician, either. He has managed to survive as Minister of Transportation under no less than 4 different governments. The old man appointed him originally, and he's managed to cling to the job in spite of the fact that almost all of the OM's appointees were kicked out during the purges of the last decade when the pragmatic tendency took over the party. They were considered too NS, most of them. Mustn't be sectarian. Too many open Nazis in government make the bourgeoisie and the prim little Christians nervous, all that crap. But Palmieri has managed to make himself virtually indispensable. We can kill 2 birds with 1 stone down in Centralia. Since Dr. Joseph Cord lives on base at the Space Center, and the McCandlesses run a bookstore downtown. Lars Frierson is now a high school teacher in the Dallas, Oregon. Dragutin Saltovic may be a little harder to track down, but he is in Seattle now. I seem to have heard that he is leaving for a concert tour in Europe next month. When do we start? Asked Nell. Right now, let's go. Go where? Asked the Afrikaner. Which of the 8 survivors of the Olympic Flying Column do we interview first?
The 9th, said Redman.
Eh? Exclaimed Nell in surprise.
Sir, the 9th survivor was Trudy Griner herself.
Not really, demurred Redman. We always say there were only 8 survivors of that ambush, 9 if we count Trude, but that's not true. There were at least 150 survivors over and above that.
The Federals, exclaimed Nell.
Exactly, including the man who defected right afterwards to our side, along with 2 of his men, and who afterwards proved himself to be a loyal volunteer and a good citizen of the Republic. I'll get us an air car from the motor pool, and then we're heading up to Bremerton. The very first person we interview this morning is the one who might be the best position to give us information on the identity of the informer, the man who was on the other side, former federal anti-terrorist officer Arthur McBride. Redman dropped into the northbound traffic lane at 300 feet over Olympia, and they grounded on 7th Street in Bremerton 20 minutes later. From there, they drove to the address that Don had programmed into the pilot bot, the one in the files for Arthur McBride. McBride himself proved to be a tall and strong-looking old man, who still had something of the erect bearing one found in the more formally trained veterans from a time of general military sloppiness. Being products of their historical time and place, the deadliest of the NVA's surviving gunmen from the War of Independence usually looked like white-haired old winos or doddering computer nerds from an age long gone. Some of them could still be seen lolling around in public places like 70-year-old teenagers with long out-of-date baseball caps stuck onto their head backwards, still playing ancient Nintendo games on their handsets, the vets only detectable by their ribbons and pistol butts visible over their waistbands. McBride's own head was smooth and silky white, and he wore a neatly trimmed salt-and-pepper mustache.
He welcomed the two boss agents into his home, a bungalow on a quiet side street, without comment or question. He was dressed in simple canvas trousers and a woolen pullover sweater. Apparently, the current 1930s look was not for him. "Let me get you both a beer," he said, coming out of his kitchen with three brown bottles. "I make my own, like a lot of the people here in the Republic, and my red ale has won a couple of ribbons over there across the water in Seattle." McBride produced three glasses from a sideboard, popped the bottle caps, and poured out. "You're retired from the labor service, I believe, sir?" asked Redmond. "Thank you," he said, as he accepted the brew. "Ta, mate," said Henny Nell, as he accepted the glass, which he hefted in salute. "Skjet en Engelsman." "Yes, Colonel. I'm retired from the labor service. After Longview, I did 20 years in the NDF, left as a command sergeant major. I never applied for officer training because of my background. It wasn't that I was worried about rejection. It's just that I would never have been comfortable with white soldiers calling me sir after what I had been. Call it penance, if you like. After that, I ended up in the labor service," he told Redmond as he poured out a glass for himself. "A lot of retired NCOs do. Almost as fulfilling as the military in many respects. I got a lot of satisfaction over the years, whipping platoons of young men and women into functional workers and willing and able to pull their weight in building a new country. I think I can honestly say that none of my boys or girls ever went to the bad in any way. That's the impression I get. I only just remembered the fact, but my son Alan served in one of your intakes," said Don. "He always spoke well of you." "The kid who later became an astronaut?" exclaimed McBride with a fond smile. "Yeah, I remember Alan. He was a fine young man. You're his father? You must be very proud of him. I understand from the news comms that he's on Mars now." "Yes, we're very proud of him. Hope he'll be home by next year sometime." "I hope so as well. Now what can I do for you, Colonel?" asked McBride, sitting down in an armchair. "Sir, I know this may be something of a sensitive subject, but I am on a job right now that involves digging up a lot of old bones. I need to ask you some questions about the time before you joined the NVA. You mean the time when I was a member of the Federal Anti-Terrorist Police Organization," replied McBride quietly. "This isn't the first time I've had state security around to try and check up on something left over from the old days. Even had a few writers and journalists and a historian from the party's Museum of the Revolution in Ballard come by." "You don't need to dance around the subject, Colonel. I don't shout the skeleton in my closet from the rooftops, true, but neither have I ever denied it to anyone with a legitimate reason to ask." "I know that, Sergeant Major," Redmond told him, "but something has come up, and you may be in a unique position to help us. My assignment has to do with the ambush that destroyed the Olympic flying column." "I rather thought it might," said McBride, pursing his lips. "I always wondered if and when the authorities in the Republic would ever get around to exhuming that particular business. I always felt that the full truth never came out. Go ahead and ask me what you want, but before you proceed, I may be able to tell you something that no one has known before." "And that is?" asked Redmond. Tell you what, let's save that for last, shall we? I'm curious to know what's brought about a revival of the Ravenhill thing this late in the day. If you'll go ahead and ask me your questions, and I can put it in context, my information may mean more." Redmond ran it down in his mind and made a quick decision to play it the old man's way. "Very well. We have received communication purporting to be from Trudy Griner," he told McBride. "If it's authentic, she says that she's coming back to the Republic on the 22nd. She claims that she's innocent, and she is demanding a public trial on the allegations against her. You can see why your recollections of that time may prove of some importance." McBride whistled softly. "Yes, I can. Boy, wouldn't that put the cat among the pigeons. I know that the Olympic flying column was set up by an informer, all right, because I was there when my Moncoid commanding officer got the call. But I have no idea on earth who it was. I told all I knew back then to Corby Morgan himself, and it was all God's own gospel truth. I figured it had better be, seeing as how, if he thought I was lying about the smallest thing, Morgan would have had me shot. I'll be glad to go over it again with you, though.
Very well, sir, said Redmond.
First, I'd like to get some personal background. In my initial briefing, President Morgan told me about the night you and those other two men came into the camp to defect.
Yes, Lance Corporal Schumacher and Sergeant Potoski. They're both dead now, I'm afraid.
Shu went with Davy Leach in Force 101, and he was killed during the cleanup by a Laotian drug gang who objected to being put out of business.
Pete was killed in an air car crash in Spokane 8 years ago.
I've never regretted that decision, Colonel. It was the most terrible and devastating one I ever made, but it had to be. It came from what the mystics call the dark night of the soul. In that moment, I left behind everything I had ever been, but in the same moment I found what I had always been looking for. This country has given me something more precious than any so-called freedom to make money hand over fist and swill consumer goods like a hog at the trough until I burst. There are some things in life more important than the freedom to go to hell in whatever way one chooses. Things like honor, duty, pride, integrity. The Northwest Republic has given me the ability to get up in the morning, look myself in the mirror, and know that was something that I had never had under the old order. Something no white man back in those days had.
Curiosity question, said Redmond. Do your neighbors and former co-workers know about your former affiliation?
Yes, I think they do, replied McBride. I am damned if I can explain how, since I never discussed it. But I guess the word simply got out in the community by osmosis or something. They all seem to know, and yet I have to say that in all the years I've lived here, not one individual in this entire community has ever caused any trouble or thrown my past in my face.
You're not the only Fed who came in from the cold, you know, said Redmond. There were thousands of defectors, people like you, who could no longer stomach what the government was doing to the white people of the Northwest.
Yes, I know, but I was unusual, being a fatpo. We were supposed to be the elite, you know, the mighty fighters against racism and fascism who swept all before us in the name of diversity, and so, très chic, elite my ass. Mother of God, I never encountered such a collection of criminal, half-insane misfits, perverts, and thugs of all races in my life. It's as if the United States government deliberately went out of their way to recruit the very worst white trash, black trash, brown trash, and yellow trash they could find. The women were worse than the men. I could never bring myself to touch one of those leprous psycho sluts, which is probably how I started to get a dubious reputation among the org. Any white male who refused to partake in drugs and sexual degeneracy was suspect. We had to be M&Ms, or, to use a less polite designation, we had to be wiggers. You know that term, Colonel? White niggers, said Redmond.
Yes, sir, I know it.
It's legally considered to be a killing word today in the Republic. You don't call a man a wigger unless you're willing to back it up all the way. The only time in my life when I ever took one of my sons out back of our house and beat him bloody with my belt was when I heard him call another boy a wigger. However carelessly and unknowingly he did so, he had to learn, and I explained to him what it meant. To his great credit, my son voluntarily went to the other boy's home and apologized, and without my telling him to do so. You got it. Blacker than the blacks, if we wanted to fit in. Monkey Meat Woodrow Coleman was the worst animal of all. I think he would have practiced cannibalism if he could have gotten away with it. Maybe towards the end there he could have. On the night I heard the WPB had finally tracked him down in Detroit, I popped the cork on a bottle of champagne. I really, really hope that some of the information I gave helped those hunters, as old as it was.
It didn't exactly happen like that, said Redmond, remembering his chat with Charlie Randall the night before.
But don't worry. Coleman had enough time to savor the moment.
I'm glad to hear it.
So why'd you join Fatpo in the first place, Mynheer? Asked Nell.
Well, if you've read your history books, you know the American economy tanked under Bush II and things never really recovered. From then on, it was permanent depression. When I came out of high school in Peoria, it was almost unlivable. I couldn't make the affirmative action quotas for college, so I went into the Marines at age 17.
By the time I was 20, I had fought counterinsurgency in the occupied lands of the oil, Raj, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Saudi, and Egypt. But things reached the point where Zog couldn't even pay its mercenaries, and I was laid off. I came out of the Corps at a time when civilian jobs for white males were almost non-existent, McBride told them. My mom was very sick with lymphatic cancer, and I had to have some kind of medical insurance that would cover her. FATPO was one of the few jobs going back in those days that still offered any benefits at all, never mind medical coverage for family. For what the hell good it did me. Mother died shortly afterwards. I hadn't been with FATPO for 3 months before I was ashamed to be seen in that uniform. God in heaven, to this day I wonder how some of the people here can forget, never mind forgive. Let me tell you something that happened to me, McBride went on. A year or so ago, I was in the park here in Bremerton, along with two of my grandchildren. I saw a man, about my own age, who was also there with his own two grandchildren. Our kids were playing together, on the swings and the monkey bars, and obviously having a great time of it all, so we nodded to one another. On his lapel, he wore the green, white, and blue ribbon from the War of Independence, but so do many of our men in this age. I noticed he had a crushed and broken nose, obviously from way back. This guy bothered me for some reason. He looked familiar, but for a long time I couldn't place him, and I got the impression he felt the same way about me. I saw him looking at me kind of funny. Then, through one of those weird coincidences in life, we recognized one another almost simultaneously. I remembered where I'd seen him before, and I could tell by the expression on his face that he'd remembered where he'd met me. It was almost 40 years ago, in an interrogation room at the Bremerton FATPO barracks. I was the one who had given him his broken nose, this horrible defacing scar he'd had to live with for the rest of his life. I did it when I smashed him in the face with a rifle butt during one of Major Woodrow Coleman's famous interrogations. There I was, confronted with my sin in the living flesh. What the hell could I do? What did you do? Asked Henny Nell. I did the only thing that was morally possible, said McBride. I walked up to that man, whose name I still didn't know, and I simply said, I was wrong. We were all wrong. I did wrong, to you and to others. All I can say to you is that, as God is my witness, I am truly sorry for the pain that I have brought into your life. And what did he say? Asked Nell, fascinated. You know what the man replied? He shook his head and said, I'm not sorry. When you bastards arrested me, I was innocent in every sense of the word. Being spirited away to a secret location and tortured by the United States was something that had happened to foreigners, dark-skinned Muslims, not good old white boys with their baseball caps on backwards like me. To this day, I don't know who ratted me out, who accused me of being involved, whether it was done for malice or money or whether it was a simple mistake. But whoever called you and told you I was a Jerry Reb had it wrong. I wasn't. Until that morning that you came for me, I never had a political or racial thought in my head. I had nothing to do with the rebellion. I thought I hated racism. I thought I loved diversity, the gorgeous mosaic and all that happy horse shit. I thought I was a good American. You showed me that I didn't want to be an American anymore. I wanted to be a man instead, a white man. When that nigger major finally decided that his underlings had blundered, he dismissed me with contempt just as some little pissant white boy not worth bothering with. Then you let me go. You threw me out the door, broken and bleeding. I crawled away, and after the wounds in my body were healed, I knew that I had to heal the wounds in my spirit. So I joined the NVA, and I fought for the rest of the war on the side of my people and our new nation. You destroyed my innocence. You destroyed the extended childhood that we used to have back in those days. But in exchange, you gave me more important things. You made me grow up. You gave me something I had never had, dignity and pride, in myself and my race. For that, sir, I will forever be grateful to you. Then what happened? Asked Sergeant Nell, still fascinated. We had nothing more to say to one another, so I walked away, said McBride. Getting back to the Ravenhill incident, you may recall that at one stage, the Federals claimed that they had located the column through satellite surveillance. What makes you so certain they didn't? What makes you certain that the Olympic flying column was betrayed by an informer? You said you were there?
I was there when a phone call came, said McBride. Our rapid reaction company was put on standby at about 6 that evening.
Nothing specific. We just hung out in the hangars by the chopper pads, in our full kit, all our weapons and with live ammo issued, ready to roll at a moment's notice. We twiddled our thumbs, smoked our dope, and waited. There was no briefing beforehand like there was normally when we were going after a specific target. A search and destroy or a sweep to arrest all white males between ages 15 and 50 in a given town for deportation to Nevada. Hell, you know the kind of things we used to do, I'm sure. When we were out for a specific purpose that had come down through the normal channels, there was a set procedure, and that wasn't followed. I was scheduled to take over as officer of the day at midnight that night. So at 12, I went to the change of quarters room to relieve Captain Hernandez. I found Major Coleman there, and he was sober, which was unusual for him at that time of night. He kept pacing around, looking at his watch, going outside for a smoke and then coming back in, nervous as a cat on a hot tin roof. It was pretty obvious that Coleman was waiting for something. "Did you ask the Kaffir what he was doing?" queried Nell. "No," answered McBride, shaking his head. Major Coleman had a history with uppity white boys like me in his command. Asking questions was considered to be insubordination, and from that, it was one step to an accusation of racism or hate crime and finding yourself on the wrong side of the wire in one of the camps. We all learned very quickly just to keep our mouths shut, do what we were told, and cash our paychecks. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm sitting behind the CQ desk, and Coleman is pacing the floor when all of a sudden his cell phone rings. His personal phone. Not the CQ phone, not the direct line secure fax from CENTCOM DHS, nothing on any of our computers. No official communication from our own people, which is the way the information would have arrived if we had picked it up from satellite surveillance or through regular intel. I always had the impression that this was something Coleman was working personally, possibly without even the knowledge of CENTCOM. Anyway, Coleman goes into his office and talks for a couple of minutes, really low. I couldn't understand anything that was said. Then he comes out and tells me to call the pad and tell them to fire up the choppers. When we get to the hangar, Coleman calls the officers and senior NCOs around, pulls out a map he or somebody had hand-sketched on a sheet of paper from a yellow legal pad, and described to us how we would set the ambush, with particular attention to the placement of the Claymore mines on the hill. I'll tell you something, Colonel. This was not a spontaneous thing. Someone had scouted that terrain at Ravenhill Ranch beforehand, and I am damned if I think it was Coleman. Monkey Meat simply wasn't that intelligent. Someone wanted that whole unit wiped out and was going to make damn sure that it happened. Someone who knew what the hell he was doing as a guerrilla and a counterinsurgency officer, and believe me, that wasn't Major Woodrow Coleman. One of your own people, asked Redmond. Then why would he let Coleman take credit for a coup like bringing down Tom Murdoch and Melanie Young? I have no idea on earth, sir, replied McBride. Coleman told us it should go down about dawn, so we would have the rising sun at our backs. We were to be on lookout for a 10-year-old OD Green Dodge pickup. That was the NVA forward scout vehicle, the one that always preceded any major troop movement of volunteers by motorized transport. Did Coleman give you any idea that he knew who would be in the forward scout? Asked Redmond. He had a deeply personal reason for asking. You mean was the informer in that vehicle? I couldn't say. If Coleman knew who it was, he didn't tell us. Replied McBride, shaking his head. He just said we were to let that vehicle pass, which was a pretty standard thing if we wanted to catch the main body of the enemy. I mean NVA, pardon me. The whole point of having a forward scout was to detect or trip any ambushes. We wanted to make sure we didn't give ourselves away. When we got back to base, I learned that the two men in the scout truck had heard the shooting, got out of their vehicle, flanked us, and inflicted a couple of casualties before they skedaddled. That's correct, agreed Redmond, remembering the only time he had spoken about Ravenhill with Bill Vitale after that fifth tanker one summer night, some years before, out on the deck behind his house. Vitale had been one of the men in the scout truck, He had broken down and wept in drunken agony when he spoke of his dead friends and comrades, something that by common consent neither of them had ever mentioned again. Go on, please. After the green pickup passed, we were to slide a mine out into the road using a Bangalore torpedo and wait for a main convoy of three vehicles, two vans, one blue and white, one Kenworth truck with slatted sides containing a large number of personnel. Whichever vehicle was in the lead, we were to blow it and stop the convoy, then give the occupants everything we had. Complete free fire zone, no quarter, no surrender. So the informer wasn't with the main convoy, conjectured Nell. Either that, or the informer was there, and for some reason, Coleman wanted to make sure he or she never made it, said McBride. Why the hell would even a Kaffir do that? Asked Nell. Most likely he didn't want to share the reward. Tom Murdoch had a $1 million price on his head, McBride reminded him. The others had bounties on them as well, starting with $200,000 for Melanie Young. You have to remember that Fatpo worked under the Department of Homeland Security, and that the rules that apply to normal federal agents or police officers didn't apply to them. We operated on what was euphemistically referred to as a performance bonus system, as a fancy name to use to conceal the fact that we were more or less bounty hunters and mercenaries, and we were able to kill or capture the more well-known NVA people. The unit involved shared the DHS reward, with the CO getting the lion's share, of course. Coleman was quite capable of having his own informant whacked simply so he wouldn't have to split the score, and maybe collect the reward for the informant as well. I hope to hell that's not what happened, because if so, then we may never know the truth, said Redmond grimly. You said you had something special to tell me. What was that?
Yeah, I have no idea at all whether it means anything, but it's the one thing I ever held back from that day. That's why I'm glad you boys came by this morning. It's time I got this off my chest. Hang on a minute, the old man told them. I need to go upstairs and get something. You boys help yourself to another beer out of the fridge. I may have to rummage around a bit.
When McBride returned after a few minutes, he had a small manila envelope in his hand, and he dumped an object from the envelope into his palm.
You know that Coleman stole the gold crucifix from Melanie Young's dead body, McBride said. He later sold it to a Jewish tabloid television show host who gave him some really obscene price for it.
Yes, I know, said Redmond. The Republic traded two American spies facing execution back to Washington government in order to get that crucifix back, but only once the blood on the cross was DNA tested and matched against Melanie's FBI records, to make sure that the bastards weren't scamming us. Our own true cross. None more true, said Nell.
None indeed, agreed Redmond.
That small gold cross and chain is now sealed in a sealed case on display in the Hall of Heroes. McBride spoke. I didn't know then how much the new nation would come to value that little gold cross, but I saw that revolting primate wrenched off the dead girl's neck, and I decided I didn't want Murdoch's body to be similarly defiled. When we got back to base camp in Bremerton, I was the officer in charge of stripping Tom Murdoch's remains down in the morgue, bagging his clothes and personal effects, photographing his corpse, fingerprinting, taking DNA samples, e-documenting everything, so forth and so on. I believe Coleman gave me the job as a little bit of added humiliation. I took something from Murdoch's body. It was on a long leather thong around his neck that had been severed by a bullet. But instead of falling onto the ground, it was actually stuck to the back of his shirt in his own blood, which is why Coleman didn't grab this as well. Here it is. Redmond took the small object of simple pewter into his hand. It's Imjolnir, a Thor's hammer, he whispered in excited awe.
You mean Tom Murdoch was an old believer? Demanded Nell.
Yes, replied McBride. I didn't know what it meant then. I thought it was just some kind of biker jewelry or something, but I knew that it was something special for him. I felt absolutely foul about what we had done, so I decided to keep this one thing out of the hands of his enemies. It wasn't a souvenir. It was my way of apologizing to him, of keeping back something from his killers. Can you understand?
Why the hell did you never say anything about this before? Demanded Redmond.
Well, to begin with, at the time, it didn't seem like a good idea to admit to my new comrades in the Northwest Volunteer Army that I had robbed the dead body of one of their greatest heroes, said McBride. Being a defector, I was on thin enough ice as things were. Later on, it just didn't seem relevant. I'm still not certain that it has any relevance to what happened to the column. Like everybody else, I bought the Trudy Griner story. I figured she sold her own people out for the shekels. Who knows? Maybe she did. God knows, it happened often enough back then. Maybe this hammer means nothing at all. I knew from overhearing Coleman's conversation on the phone that night that there was an informer. Ever since then, everyone said that Griner did it for money, and I have seen the problems that this religious divide among our people has produced in Republic society. Why should I add to those problems by revealing that the great warrior and commander Tom Murdoch was really a follower of the Aesir and was getting it on out of wedlock with a woman whom Christians regard as our own Saint Joan of Arc? I owed Corby Morgan a big one, because when we came to him and told him we wanted to defect, he believed us. He didn't put a bullet in our heads and bury us out in the woods. How widespread was the knowledge that Tom Murdoch was an old believer? Asked Redmond, urgently. You got me, Colonel. You'll recall that I was on the other side when Murdoch was commanding the column. I got some of the intelligence briefings, and I do recall that even the FBI and Homeland Security were trying to exploit religious divisions within the racially conscious community in the Northwest, but I don't recall any specific mention of Murdoch's religious affiliation. If the feds knew, it never trickled down to my level. As to what I picked up since then, well, I heard a couple of remarks down through the years that would indicate to me that Murdoch's religious views were known in the NVA. How widespread that knowledge was, I don't know at all. One last thing, Mr. McBride. I noticed that you don't wear the War of Independence ribbon yourself, asked Redmond. Of course not, replied McBride in a puzzled voice. Why would I? On 10/22, I wear the Missoula Salient Medal and the Operation Strikeout campaign decoration with the Chilliwack bar because I earned them as a soldier in the NDF wearing the uniform of the Republic. But nothing from the NVA time, and I never go to reunions or old fighters' functions. How could I? I fought against the Republic, and I was responsible for the death and torture of volunteers. I had done what I could to make up for that, but for me to wear the ribbon would be an insult to the memory of those who died because of me. An insult to the living survivors as well, like that man I told you about in the park in Bremerton, whom I mutilated for life when I obeyed the orders of a monkey. Suppose I were to meet him at a reunion. What should I do then? Buy him a beer and toast the old days? I don't deserve that decoration in the same sense that men like you do. Please give me credit for some sense of dignity and propriety, Colonel. According to your service records, you were there with the NDF Second Army when we went into Portland to implement the provisions of the Longview Treaty? Asked Redmond. Yeah, so I was. So what? So were thousands of others. A Battle of the Bridges? Pressed Dawn? I believe that's what it's called nowadays, yes, admitted McBride carelessly. I don't recall it as a battle, just an especially nasty day in the life. In the official military history of the NVA/NDF, the Battle of Portland Bridges is considered to be one of the most important engagements in the War of Independence. The enemy sought to deny the Second Army entry into Portland, and we had to bop our way in. By NDF regulations, anyone who participated in that fight in any capacity is entitled to wear the green, white, and blue ribbon, said Redmond. It was the first time since 1945 that white soldiers faced down the Zog bastards on equal terms, in the open, face-to-face, man-to-man, gun-to-gun, artillery-to-artillery, tank-to-tank, and whooped their kosher asses up one side and down the other. Tell me, are you not the same volunteer Arthur McBride who ran forward onto northbound Interstate 205 bridge over the Columbia River out of Portland and disarmed the explosive charges that the U.S. Army Rangers had planted there? Asked Don, along with volunteer Brooke Arnold, under heavy fire from the enemy. Yeah, so? Responded McBride with a shrug. It was a long time ago, and just one incident in 1,000. Most of the Ranger fire was directed against the southbound lanes, where the charges were disarmed by volunteers Steve Carter, Eric Mwegi, Rick Nesty, all of whom won very well-deserved Iron Crosses. All Brooke and I caught over in the northbound lanes were a couple of pot shots. She caught a rather bad one, if I recall correctly from your service file. Did you not drag Volunteer Arnold to safety after she was hit, and in return to complete your mission, in the process shooting and killing with a pistol two Rangers who attempted to prevent you?
Yes. Why do you ask? Asked McBride curiously.
I haven't thought about that incident for years. What does it have to do with...
Last night, my wife and I attended the old fighters' reunion in Olympia. We didn't see you.
And that's unfortunate, because you had every right to be there, and every year our numbers grow fewer. It's your decision, but I hope we'll see you there next year.
You may consider that a personal invitation. We have a very good medical service in the Republic. We especially pride ourselves on our geriatric care. That means you have some years left to you. During that time, Sergeant Major McBride, I would appreciate it if you would wear your War of Independence ribbon openly upon your person. You earned it, and you need to let those young people coming up in our nation know that. You have set a very good example thus far. Set a better one. Wear your ribbon, and wear your Iron Cross, the one you won by your heroism on that Portland Bridge. I read Volunteer Arnold's report this morning before coming to see you, by way of background information.
Then you didn't read it right. I earned nothing. It was all her. What you didn't read was that chubby little blonde girl had more courage in her little finger than I ever had in my whole body on the best day of my life. After Ravenhill, I ended up with Commandant Archie McLean down in Oregon. From the moment I saw Brooke lying in an ambush outside of Medford, big floppy hat on her head and golden hair in a braid down her back, an AK-47 in her hands and longing to give any nigger or Mexican who crossed her path a heavy dose of shock and awe, my past was dead. She was my life from that point on. Ike low crawled up to her in that ambush position, my rifle in my arms, and I looked into those icy blue eyes and said, "I'm Art McBride. Are you married or with anybody?" She said, "No." Then I said, "Tell me what I have to do for you to be my wife." She said, "Kill as many of them as you can, and never rat, no matter what they do to you, and never lie to me." I said, "You got it. Can we consider ourselves engaged?" She looked at me and said, "Yeah. Now get back to your firing position. Fatty's coming." I started to crawl back, and then I looked over my shoulder and asked her, "What's your name?" "Brooke," she said. Then it all started anew for me. I wasn't fighting for any of you anymore. I wasn't fighting to redeem myself or my past. I was fighting for her. Fighting to be worthy of her. I would have done anything, anything at all, to be worthy of her. You wouldn't understand.
"You'd be surprised," replied Redmond. With me, it was an 11-year-old girl with braces and pigtails. I was 12 years old myself, and I would have gone up against Godzilla with nothing but a rusty steak knife in my hand for one of her smiles. Her Godzilla was the United States government, and from the moment I saw her... Yeah, it was like that. If it hadn't been for Brooke, I would have run like a bunny off that bridge, said McBride, nodding with a small smile.
What happened to Comrade Arnold after the war? Asked Nell curiously.
Through some incomprehensible grace of God that I never deserved, she kept her word and I married her, and for that I damn sure earned an Iron Cross. God, Brooke was a world-class bitch. I loved her. She loved me, and we both knew it, and we spent our lives rending one another's entrails with unutterable joy. I fought a long and bitter war so that I could spend the next 30 years wrestling an alligator, gentlemen, and I would not trade you one single moment of it for any consideration.
Children? Asked Redmond.
6. 5 living. Our eldest son, Jason, opted to do his national service in the Kriegsmarine, and he went down on the Cornwallis during the Chinese attack off Juneau. The other 5 are alive and well, thank God, and they load me up with all the rugrats I can handle every weekend.
Your wife died 2 years ago, I believe? Asked Redmond, quietly.
Yes, she was out in the garden weeding a flower bed, and she moved wrong, pulled on something too hard, and a weak spot in her aorta from that American bullet that none of the doctors ever detected tore and flooded her heart with blood. I found her too late. She died in my arms. I'm marking my time now until death reunites us. She was the last combat casualty from the Revolution, you might say.
Will there be anything else, gentlemen?
Asked Arthur McBride.
No, sir. You've been of great assistance.
So now we have yet another motive for the betrayal of the Olympic Flying Column, besides mere money and treason or unrequited love. said Nell, shaking his head in bemusement as they got back in their unmarked air car. Religious bigotry.
Lecker.
Yes, so it would seem, agreed Redman, his voice grim and a scowl on his lips. We also have a potential disaster worse than any conceivable on our hands. Betrayal for money or by a federal spy we could handle. That happened all the time. It is sordid, but historically acceptable. The romance angle with Murdoch, Melanie, and Trudy adds a gothic and interesting, but politically harmless, possibility. But if it turns out that the flying column was betrayed because of some tub-thumping Christian couldn't handle the fact that the party's greatest hero was an Odinist, then it could fatally ignite a full-scale battle between the umpteen factions here in the Republic, all of whom demand that their own beliefs be formally recognized as our official state religion. That is the one thing that could lose us everything that we have gained since the Revolution. Jesus Christ on a raft! Now I hope it was Trudy and that she did sell us out for money, or else because she got dumped by Tom Murdoch.